Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll start with the weekly wrap today. We'll segue nicely into when for richer, for poorer really means something. That's marriage across class lines. And we'll end with whether women really can have it all anymore. The answer is yes, by the way, but not the way things are right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 22nd of June. Good as always to have you here. Lots to get to today. Markets, the banks, the Fed meeting this past week. Not to mention a highly symbolic but completely predictable European soccer game to tell you about. We will start, though, with an analysis of the 5 days gone by. Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond is what we like to call that. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher here from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC. They're in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, John. So Moody's yesterday, after the bell, came out and said, you know what? There are 15 big global banks. We don't think they're all that creditworthy anymore. We're going to downgrade them. And yet today, the banking sector on the stock market was up. What's going on? Why do we care?
Well, first of all, they telegraphed that this was coming four months ago. They put them all on credit watch. So everybody knew that they were reviewing the creditworthiness of the banks even earlier. So a lot of the downgrades had already been, as they say, priced into the market.
Right.
And people were actually relieved that the downgrades weren't worse than they were, that the banks weren't cut even further. And on top of that, you had the feeling that, well, okay, this is the cut that was coming, and probably things are going to stay right where they are for quite some time.
Yeah, all right, Lee, pick up on that. Does this augur ill for our banking future, or can we now just sort of take it easy and say, okay, the banks are going to have to hold more collateral against bad loans and all that stuff, and it's going to be good?
Well, I mean, they already do hold more collateral. They already have capital cushions that are like twice what they were 4 years ago. They've already gone through all this stuff. I mean, the banks are, yes, they have headwinds. Pick your headwind, you know, like trading revenues down. There's tons of more regulation, even though there's not enough. There's a lot less M&A.
Yeah.
There's changes to fee structures. This is not news. This is like non-news.
All right. But humor me. We're going to spend 30 more seconds on
okay.
it. John, pick your headwind. What's the headwind now?
I think the major headwind is the fact that banks, because they have to have higher capital, as the Basel Capital Accords kick in.
Come on, I'm not explaining that.
I know. Well, they have to have, let's just say the banks have to have lots and lots more capital, which
okay.
means that it's costlier for them to do things like make loans, which means that they'll earn less for their shareholders, which hurts their stock price. And that's the major headwind, I think, going forward.
Right. And when I say not news, I mean that, you know, Moody's is just too, it's too little too late here. I mean,
right.
We already
right.
know all this stuff.
Right, exactly. All right, so moving on. Let's see. Item two on my list here is Ben Bernanke. The Federal Reserve had a meeting Tuesday, Wednesday. The Fed chairman had one of his press conferences afterward. He came out and he said this.
Good afternoon. As indicated in the statement released earlier this afternoon.
Yada, yada, yada.
Okay, so that's what we actually played on Wednesday. did I do him a disservice, Lee? I mean, they didn't really do all that much, right?
No, it's kind of in the week of that. I mean, we had the president's press conference on Monday night, which also, you know, there's a lot of non-movement and a lot of fanfare around that non-movement. I think it's because people are, you know, everybody's a little bit nervous that things are starting to teeter a little bit more than it seemed just a few weeks ago or a month ago.
Okay, so John, if people are getting nervous, and the chairman said in his defense, he said, listen, if things get really bad, we'll do something. If things are getting bad, why isn't he doing something now?
I think that's a very good question. The big risk here, I think, is that the Fed waits too long. They want to, you know, as they say, keep some dry powder so that if things get really bad, they can say, but we have this in our vaults. But, you know, the question is, what if they wait so long that when they pull this out, whatever this happens to be, it's, you know, it's already too late and the train's already rolling off the tracks. I think we're in a very precarious situation.
Lee, this, whatever it is that they're going to pull out, it's got to be in response to Europe, right?
I think that's the latest catalyst. It's all baked in together, though. I mean, it's our continuing slowdown, which is in turn, you know, Europe is kicking in and helping that. I mean, Europe is a huge deal. It's getting worse, and there's no confidence that anything is going to be resolved. Whatever happens next week in Brussels, it's just more and more of the same.
Yeah. All right, we got to go. John Carney from CNBC, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Have yourselves a good weekend, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
You have a good weekend too.
See you. Bye bye. On Wall Street this Friday, not so bad, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just when you thought you couldn't possibly lose any more privacy, allow me to introduce you to Maps Coordinate from Google. Uses the same technology that Google Maps does, with a twist of sorts. It lets companies with big mobile workforces, salespeople and what have you, keep tabs on those workers wherever they are, whenever they get there. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more now on Google's newest search engine.
Apparently, my fellow New Yorkers aren't always at work when they're supposed to be.
Craziest thing I've done on company time was check out a full feature film. It was Death to Smoochie.
Snuck out and dipped my nails.
Gone to Macy's to go shopping.
We all went to a bar and got pretty tanked.
The fine art of playing hooky might be tanking too. Google's Maps Coordinate lets your employer use your phone to see where you are on a map every 5 seconds. Google's been beta testing the product with utility companies, telecom companies, and pizza delivery companies.
Since your operations team uses Google Maps Coordinate to visualize all workers and jobs on one map, when a problem arises, they can quickly assign jobs to the nearest available worker. And in this case,
Maps Coordinate costs $15 per month per employee. AT&T and IBM have similar services.
Tracking mobile employees is a big business.
Jeff Jarvis is the author of Public Parts, a book about privacy. He says companies need to be careful.
If an employer used this service to snoop on employees, that I think will lead to a backlash.
Or maybe not. Brad McCarty is managing editor at The Next Web. He points out that people broadcast their locations all the time with Facebook and Foursquare.
I think for businesses, it's probably a great tool.
Would you voluntarily be tracked?
Wow. I'm not sure.
Google points out Coordinate has an invisible function. So if you're, say, ducking out for a quick matinee, you can do it off the grid. In New York, at my desk, working, as always, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
From the Wealth and Poverty Desk now, a look at marriage. Here's a nod to the power of tradition, it being June and all. This is still a popular month for getting married in this country, but here's a new trend. Americans are much less likely to marry across class lines than they were 50 years ago. That is, when it comes to income and education, it's not as common as it used to be for opposites to attract. So Marketplace's Chrissy Clark went out and had a look at what happens when richer and poorer do make a go of it.
Last fall, Michelle Ryder and Chris Hevener, young and in love, went to check out Occupy Wall Street at Zuccotti Park. Standing together at the birthplace of the chant, "We are the 99%, struck them both as a little weird, because Michelle and Chris grew up in very different percents. Michelle's dad painted cars, and her mom was a receptionist, so she definitely comes from the 99. But her boyfriend, Chris, he inherited a trust fund.
I would identify as someone coming from the 1%.
And yet, somehow, at this moment in history where class war has popped back up in the American phrasebook, Chris and Michelle are making class love. They live together, are thinking about marriage, but they say it's hard coming from such different class backgrounds. Even talking about coming from such different class backgrounds. And
how uncomfortable these kind of conversations are sometimes.
The one I'm forcing you into right now.
Yeah.
It's rude to talk about somebody being more privileged than somebody else. Social class is such a taboo topic in American society.
Susan Fiske is a professor of psychology at Princeton. She looks at how social class shapes our daily interactions. And what she's found sounds like a warning label for couples like Chris and Michelle. Consider the experiment where Fiske put volunteers in MRIs and showed them pictures of people from different classes. When they got to the photos of really poor people, the part of the brain that normally lights up when we see another human being,
that part of the brain doesn't come on when people look at poor people. What we find is that people say it's hard to think about this person as a three-dimensional human being.
That's just one example of the kind of subconscious hurdles cross-class couples have to jump. And yet, some of them make it over.
I can show you some of the boxes of CDs. These are all jazz, blues.
There's the Blueberry Hill album cover.
I found my thrill.
Bruce Levine and Mary Childers live in New Hampshire on a road called Blueberry Hill, which Bruce has commemorated in his very enormous CD collection. A little too enormous for Mary.
I think it's astonishing.
I do have a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 1,000.
Mary grew up on welfare. She went on to get a graduate degree and has a good job, but most of her family is still struggling, and she often lends them money. Mary says that gives her a really different perspective than her husband, whose family is solidly upper middle class.
A different sense of who has a claim on us financially.
Mm-hmm.
I'm acutely aware that I have relatives who have trouble putting gas in their cars to go to work. And so I'm always thinking of not being too self-indulgent.
And I've always allowed myself to purchase certain things fairly guilt-free. I don't worry about not having money to send to family.
The secret was...
Oh, gosh, I know what you're going to say.
It was her teeth.
Yeah.
Iris and Andre Luck live in Virginia. When they first met nearly 30 years ago, their different class backgrounds came up almost immediately when Iris smiled.
Because she has beautiful teeth and I don't.
Iris says she'd taken her smile for granted until she met Andre. It had never occurred to her that...
You can determine the economic class of someone by looking at their teeth, but it also caused me to remember I started going to the dentist when I was 6. I had braces, you know, the whole thing.
Things that when Andre was young, his family told him they just couldn't afford.
We were poor. We have bills to pay, not bills to create.
The Lucks say they've discovered class differences hiding in lots of the moments they've shared over the years. Different expectations, different ways of communicating. When Iris spends time with Andre's family, she catches herself trying not to talk too much about her own life.
Because I think I might be perceived as someone who is trying to put herself above them or looking down at them in some way.
Which
I have been accused of.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's been true.
I agree.
But I think it's an issue of whenever you're communicating, you should
know
your
audience.
So what do all the differences about money and family and dentistry that come up in cross-class relationships have to do with the rest of us?
Well, we are in cross-class relationships. Every single one of us are.
Jennifer Ladd is a founder of Class Action, a group that gives workshops to couples and businesses on how to bridge class divides. She says as income inequality has widened in the last few decades, there are fewer shared places where rich and poor intermingle. But when we do meet on the street or in a taxi or over a checkout counter,
let's see each other and take a moment to not just see their role and put them in a status of higher or lower, but see that human being.
We may not be married to them, but we live in a country where there are class differences, for richer or for poorer, till death do us part. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
We've got great pictures of Iris and Andre and some other couples tying the cross-class knot on our website. It's marketplace.org. Head on over to see them and to share your own photos and stories of relationships across the class divide. Coming up, work, family, and whether women really can have it all anymore.
But then I want to say to other women, look, you can do it with kids if you have more flexibility.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rebounded 67 points today, about a half percent, closed to 12,640, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ picked up 33 points, 1.1%, 2,892 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, 0.7%, finished at 1,335. For the week, the Dow gave back 1%. The NASDAQ deleted about a half percent. The S&P 500 down 0.6% since Monday. Apparently, the ratings cuts that got priced in yesterday weren't as big as expected. Bank of America and Wells Fargo both climbed about 1.5%. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley each advanced roughly 1.3%. Citigroup ticked up about 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.67%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of May. Swimmers begin competing in Omaha, Nebraska for a spot on the 2012 U.S. Olympic team. And 3 years ago, on Monday, Michael Jackson died in Los Angeles. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Well, it's over. The European thing. Germany finally got what it wanted, hammered the Greeks into submission. Soccer. People, I'm talking soccer. The European Championships. Germany beat Greece 4-2 today in the quarterfinals. The debt crisis, though, well, that's still going strong. And it gets us to this.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
Ireland today and Louise Williams. We had her on a couple of weeks ago talking about the Irish referendum on the European bailout package. So we called her back up. Louise, good to talk to you again.
And you, Kai, how are you doing?
I'm well, but, you know, I'm calling you to find out what's going on over there. So what's new?
Okay, so the last time we spoke, I was in kind of this moment of tension. The referendum was was underway. How were we going to vote? Nobody knew. What would the outcome be? And we'd come to the end of a series of weeks of really quite intensive debate about what is Ireland's role within Europe? What is Ireland's role within the Eurozone? All of those big questions. And I'm not saying that we came up with the right answers or if it's even clear, the referendum that we voted on, what the implications were. But we did have that debate. And now, not much. Do you know, it's sort of... I'd love to be... Yeah, well, kind of our eyes are turned towards Greece, towards Spain. And, you know, nobody wants Greece to go through more pain. And yet, their economy at the moment would be somewhat weaker than ours. So if they were to leave the euro, would that strengthen our position as a small country within the eurozone? Or would that make us even more vulnerable? We had that very intense discussion. And now we don't quite know what's going to happen next. And maybe the whole project will be thrown out the window anyway.
It sort of sounds like the Irish are doing what the Irish do, which is just muddling through.
You know, that's really it. And kind of keep the head down. Hope that we'll get along, show that there's lots of goodwill to do what Europe wants us to do. And I think there's a fair chance that we will manage to muddle through this crisis. But who knows?
Well, what's the fun news, Louise? Come on, help me out.
I know. You want me to be upbeat. I know. Okay, so we did really badly in the Euros.
In the soccer game. Yeah,
yes.
Oh yeah.
I mean, really badly, Kai. Like really, you know, 4-0, total humiliation. We sang beautifully after the matches, I will say that much. But I don't know if this picture would have reached you in the US, but it's a photo that was taken at Dublin Airport, and it's a photo of fans that were leaving for Poland.
For the football game, for the Euro 2012,
yeah. And they have the tricolour of the green, the white and the orange. And printed across it, I don't know how they got this printed up, but they got printed across it, Angela Merkel thinks we're at work. And they're at Dublin Airport flying out.
Oh, that's actually horrible. Come on.
No, it's hilarious. No, it's absolutely hilarious. But it's not only was that hilarious and made us all laugh like drains, but that banner has been sold at auction for about €20,000, and all of that money is going towards cancer charities and children's cancer charities and all sorts of brilliant causes.
That's good. So good does come out of the European debt crisis yet, right?
Just about. And we had a giggle about that flag. Come on, you've got to be cheeky about it.
You're right. Louise Williams, she's, where are you, Dublin?
Dublin, absolutely.
Right,
Grail, Dublin.
We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you again.
There was news this week that California is going to let private companies manage some of its state parks. Six of them, mostly up in Northern California. It's all part of a last-ditch effort to stave off park closures while the state tries to bridge a canyon-sized budget gap. But Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports running a state park ain't exactly easy money.
Just to be clear, California's not selling the parks to corporations. No Budweiser Beach, in other words. It's outsourcing the day-to-day operations, says parks advocate Jerry Emery.
They're not going to be putting up billboards or building hotels in state parks. They're simply going to keep the parks open while trying to make a profit.
Trying may be the key word there. Phil McNally, a former parks chief in North Carolina, says corporations don't realize running a state park is no picnic.
Having to eradicate kudzu or other invasive species.
Kudzu eradication? Not exactly a moneymaker. McNally says then you've got your sewer lines that break, vandalism, domestic disputes around the campfire, people who trip over a log and sue you. Oh, and pot grove patrol. Do companies really want this job?
I don't think many folks have given those kinds of things consideration.
Actually, Steve Werner has. He's VP at American Land and Leisure in Utah. His company already runs campgrounds and national forests. It'll start managing three California parks on August 1st. Werner says his company only bid on the ones with a healthy gate and ship-shape infrastructure. And as for those rowdy campers?
Well, hopefully residents in California are just as well-behaved as they are in the rest of the country, and we won't run into the need to bring in armed guards to keep an eye on things.
And if companies like Werner's can't make a profit off California's public parks, they can always ask the state permission to raise fees. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, Anne Marie Slaughter was quite literally at the top of her profession. A professor of international relations at Princeton, she was on a two-year leave to work directly for Hillary Clinton at the State Department. Challenging, engaging, and important work in her chosen field. Until she decided it wasn't working for her anymore, that her family needed her more than her job did. That despite the line that women can have it all, they really can't. At least, not the way things work right now. Anne Marie Slaughter will be the first to tell you that according to most definitions, she does have it all. But she writes in the latest edition of The Atlantic magazine that more women ought to be able to as well. Anne Marie Slaughter, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
You believe, and you say in this piece, that women can have it all, but not the way the world works today, right? Not the way society is structured. How do we get from here to where you want us to be then?
Well, we start by having a really honest conversation about the barriers. And the reason I wrote the piece was that simply telling younger women, you can do it, you know, if you want it badly enough and if you marry the right person, is not enough. I don't think that's honest. And a lot of women are out there blaming themselves when, in fact, we can make a lot of changes. We can make it much easier for women and, again, men to work outside the office, as many sort of new innovative businesses are already doing. We can make it such that women and men can take, you know, time out in the sense of deferring promotions. And we can change the way we look at both men and women and say, look, wanting to spend time with your kids does not make you any less a committed professional.
So you want it to be our choice, right? Whether it's a woman's choice or a man's choice. I mean, you can be a female heart surgeon, but it's tough to be a female heart surgeon and a full-time mom.
Absolutely. So I would say to young women, you want to be a heart surgeon, just like I would say to a man, then you really do need a mate who is going to be willing to be there for the kids more or less full time. And frankly, you're going to have to recognize that there's going to be a lot of times where there's going to be a lot of tugging, you know, in terms of your heartstrings and your emotions, but that's the choice you've made. But then I want to say to other women, look, you can do it with kids if you have more flexibility. I think we can make this kind of change, but we have to really be honest, first of all, and then committed.
There's a current events part of this thing as well, right? As you try to generate this discussion to change what happens in the workplace in America and society, we're a country with 8.2% unemployment. We're down 8 million jobs from the beginning of the recession. What's the incentive to change the structure now when we're still trying to figure out how to get the economy going?
I'd say immediately, again, the demographic that I'm writing for, that's not the demographic that's unemployed, right? So where the people I'm talking about have options, but they are not exercising those options in various ways because they feel deeply conflicted or they just can't make it work. They can't have, you know, young children and a fully high-powered job or teenagers and a fully high-powered job. And we've got to somehow put more play in those joints.
Would you have given up your chance to run policy planning at the State Department for Hillary Clinton to have had a more active time with your children in their early teenager?
No.
Aha, right? I mean,
and that's part of the message. I'm not saying, look, you can't have these things. I'm saying the toll is high, and I expected that if I had the opportunity to stay, absolutely I'd stay. But I, when the time was up, I was very anxious to come home and very glad to be home. But no, I wouldn't give it up for those 2 years. But those 2 years are going to be, you know, all I could manage at this stage of my life and career.
Yeah. Anne-Marie Slaughter is a professor of politics and international affairs at Princeton by day, by night, and full-time, actually. She's a mom. She's got two boys.
Yes.
Anne-Marie, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
There's more of my talk with Anne-Marie Slaughter on our website, marketplace.org. The article she wrote, it's called Why Women Still Can't Have It All, is in the July-August issue of The Atlantic magazine.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, it's a follow-up to an item from a couple of weeks ago. Former Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling and his video game company, 38 Studios, it was called, that went belly up after getting a $75 million loan guarantee from the state of Rhode Island. After not saying much, if anything, publicly, Schilling went on the Dennis and Callahan show on WEEI in Boston this morning.
You know, I sat down with my family and explained about a month ago to them that 38 Studios was probably going to fail and go bankrupt, mm-hmm. and that the money that I had earned and saved during baseball was probably all gone.
You look it up at baseballreference.com, and you see Schilling made about $114 million in his 19-year career in the big leagues. Today, the Dow rebounded 67 points, about 0.5%, closed at 12,640. The NASDAQ up 33 points, 1.1%. 2892 is the number you're looking for. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, 0.7%, 1335. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Well, this is one of those where the tape just kind of speaks for itself.
I matched the front and rear sights with my zombie and slowly squeezed the trigger.
Whoa! Oh, jeez.
Test takes aim at financial security. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You have yourself a good weekend. She gets to do all the fun stuff, man. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.